To the Jackie Daily Show. You can subscribe to the show for free on iHeartRadio, iTunes, or SoundCloud, my personal favorite. All right, hey, before I even get started, I want to tell you that next week I'm having former EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt on the show. I am so excited about that. I have loved that man from afar. He is the greatest EPA Administrator ever. We've had 15 now. He is by far the most bold, the most courageous. I covered his work extensively, and last week I got to interview him on a stage in Dallas, Texas, right beside Ryan Zinke, your former Secretary of the Interior, but more importantly, a commander in the U.S. Navy SEALs before that. And the two of them just laid out the U.S. energy revolution and what it means to the country. But Scott Pruitt, I found out in the time I could spend with him before the event, on the phone and in person, he is just a gem of a human being. He is a sweetheart. He is a good man. I genuinely enjoyed meeting him. I was honored to be in his presence. I just knew that, you know, I collect good people in my life. I collect people. And I met him. I'm like, wow, this guy's amazing. And so whatever you've heard about him in the press, I am ready to take it on. I am ready to throw down for Scott Pruitt. He's going to be on the show next week. And, you know, I'll ask him about some of these things that you've read about in the press. Give him his chance to take his shot at his critics and talk about some of the big stuff he's doing now. So that's coming up next week again on Jackie Daily. But this week, I'm going to talk with my former boss of 7 years, Congressman Trent Franks, who founded the Congressional EMP Caucus, about your president's executive order to finally protect your electric grid from EMP, electromagnetic pulse, right? That can be either a solar flare from the sun, they happen like once every 150 years, or a hostile foreign country can detonate a weapon to simulate an EMP and fry the U.S. electric grid and all electronics. It is the biggest asymmetric weapon for terrorists, for rogue states. The Iranians have said 22 times in their military doctrine it's their weapon of choice against the United States. The North Koreans have said the same. And finally, we have a president who's going to get out in front of this and get this done. I almost can't believe it. I'm just that happy. I've been talking about this for 4.5 years. Trent Franks worked on this for over a decade. Other people before him. It's our greatest vulnerability, frankly. And finally, you know, the Israelis already got this done based on the briefings of my former boss, Congressman Trent Franks, and his colleagues. The Brits are working on this. The Russians and the Chinese do drills on this. This is very serious. And finally, we might get out in front of this problem before some madman decides it's time to fry the grid. So Trent Franks and I will talk about that later on. I will also speak with Jason Isaac from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And he ran a bill in Texas last legislative session to eliminate daylight savings time. There has been a move to do this nationwide. In other words, California and New York and Hawaii were all in the same time. I am 100% in favor of this. Do you know, I used to believe, and I've been told all my life, that we have daylight savings time because we were an agricultural country. Back when we adopted it, back in 1918 or so. And it's all about helping farmers get more in their day. You know what? That's a big, bold, brazen lie. Everyone who ever told me that was lying to me. It turns out, Jason Isaac knows this because it's his bill, the Germans did this in World War I. They decided to chop up the days and time zones around the world because they believed it would conserve energy and help them win World War I. That's how this happened. For most of mankind's history, we were not cursed with daylight savings time. You didn't miss a flight because the time was wrong. You didn't miss a meeting because people got their time zones mixed up. Nothing like that ever happened. We can go back to those days. Why are we letting the Germans set policy? They're the worst. I actually like Germany a lot, but they're the last country you look to for governance. Okay, they're the worst. And did you know that in the week following a time change, right, whether you spring forward or you fall back, we have more heart attacks and car accidents in that week? And Jason says it's because of stress. People are sleep deprived. They're stressed out. They're late because they got the time wrong, whatever. And I, you know what? He has the stats to prove it. He's got the data. This is real. So, and besides, you don't legislate more daylight in the day. God decides that, please. So what's the point of this? All right, so Jason's going to talk about that because the effort is renewed and we may yet live to see America with no time zones. Then I'm going to tell you about Duke University getting busted in research fraud. Research fraud. Can you believe that? Would a PhD lie to you? You know, I've been scrutinizing some climate scientists on this show and taking a lot of heck for it. People want to say you're anti-science, anti-elite. No, no, no. I'm just anti-lie. Here, $112 million paid out by Duke for 7 years of fraud. Dozens of research grants. The guy who's the whistleblower in this action gets $33.75 million. This is a QI-TAM action. You heard of that? QI-TAM, it's Latin. It means for the king. Because it goes back to the days of England. If someone didn't pay their taxes to the king, and you told the king about it, guess what? You get a cut. And that's exactly what a QI-TAM action is in the United States. It's a federal claim against a federal agency, in this case, the EPA and the National Institutes of Health gave the grants big money, and they were just falsifying the experiments. They weren't even doing them. Can you believe that? Just making it up. Then they get published in, what, 38 journals and then cited in 417 others? This is what's called peer review. This is peer-reviewed work, my friend. You can't contest it. Well, it turns out there are here and there unscrupulous people. This researcher who got caught red-handed at Duke also got caught embezzling. So she's just a bad actor. But you know what? Northwestern paid out money. Cornell paid out money. University of Florida paid out money. I'm talking about millions of dollars. And I promise you, they're not the only ones. You have to ask yourself, what is the oversight of federal grants to study lung function in mice? That's what Duke was doing. And it was $112 million in payout. I don't know about you. I'm not 100% sure how excited I am as a taxpayer to be paying big money for that in the first place. Dozens of grants, 7 years. So I'd like to encourage you. If you're working in the nation's universities and they're receiving taxpayer dollars, wouldn't you like to get rich fast? You need to file a QI-TAM action. You know what? Call my friend Trey Mayfield in Washington, D.C. He does QI-TAM actions. He just went to the Supreme Court. He's excellent. No, I'm very serious. I hate fraud. I hate dishonesty. And this is actually noble. This man made $33.75 million being the whistleblower. Now, it's not without costs. Took on this big institution, cost him a lot of money because he got fired and didn't have a job for over a year. And listen, it's taking on a huge bureaucracy. You're taking on the man. You know what I mean? He was the underdog, but it worked out for him. I predict this is the tip of the iceberg of research fraud. Every now and then you hear about it. You know what? Google Michael Mann. Remember the guy with the hockey stick diagram on global warming? Check out the court cases with Michael Mann as a party, as a defendant. Now, I want you to see. This guy is cited all over the place like he's some authority. Do you know what happened to him in federal court? I've covered it before on the show, but it's been a long time. He has been exposed. And you know what? In fact, Google Michael Mann. That's two N's. Exposed. You know what? I'm out of time for this segment. I'm out of time for this show. I'm already booked up, but I will cover this. I've already covered it before, but it's worth a reminder. You don't just trust someone because they have letters after their name and just because they got published in a nice journal and were cited hundreds of times, as you see here in the Duke University example. We'll talk more about it later in the show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You can join us online on Instagram and on Twitter at Jackie Daly Show to continue the conversation and subscribe for free on iHeartRadio, iTunes, SoundCloud, and most other major podcasting outlets. I've been telling you for 4.5 years about why the government, the federal government, must secure the electric grid against attack. And specifically, we've drilled down to EMP attacks, electromagnetic pulse. You remember me telling you about this. This is a completely debilitating attack on the U.S. grid. It can be either natural, as in a solar flare from the sun, for example, or more likely, maybe man-made. That is, mankind has created a weapon that can simulate a solar flare that will fry the electric grid. And this is the weapon of choice of our enemies across the ocean, as they've said openly and explicitly. And finally, you have a president, I cannot believe this almost, who's issued an executive order to address this problem, the EMP problem, building on literally decades of work by my former boss, Congressman Trent Franks, who represented Phoenix, Arizona area, the Northwest quadrant there. He was the chairman of the EMP caucus in Congress for so many years, and really everything I know about this issue I owe to him, and frankly, so many other issues too. This is the one big energy issue, though, that we worked on, and people don't know. It was years of toil in the wilderness by Trent Franks, leading his colleagues in the U.S. House and being an expert, by the way, to the White House and the Senate too, who made this happen foundationally. And so, Mr. Franks, it's really good to have you back on the show. Welcome back.
Jackie, it is so wonderful to talk with you again. I have to just say, I know you already know I believe it, but I believe you're the smartest person I ever had the privilege of having to work with me. And I just want to, first of all, congratulate you on all the wonderful things that have been happening in your life and on your show. You've been going a long time, and just grateful to have an opportunity to be on the program with you.
Well, thank you. I am grateful to have you here for all kinds of reasons. I miss working for you. Those were 7 super fun, action-packed years on Capitol Hill in the personal office and also as your counsel for the subcommittee on the Constitution. And so I just want you to know, I will always look back on that time in my life as one of the high points of excitement and meaningfulness in my life, to be present for all of those things. And I'm only there, was ever there, because you put me there. And so thank you for opening that door and giving me the chance.
Well, I will tell you, the advantage was all mine, Jackie. And I know that we're having a little bit of back and forth in trying to build each other up. But let me just suggest to you that it was my precious advantage to have you in that office the day that you walked in. I remember it still. And I look back and I see so many wonderful things. I mean, just a few days ago in Kentucky, they passed a bill that we had literally written in our office that now was spawned by some of the things that we did. And I look at that all over the country and see some of the good things that have happened. And so I just go ahead and embarrass you one more moment and say thank you, Jackie, for what you did for this country. And thank you for letting me witness it. And I know God's going to do great things with you in the future, and you're just getting started.
Well, thank you, sir. It was, I promise you, it was an honor, but it was also fun. It was super fun to be there.
It was fun.
Yeah. And most people don't get to have that much fun at the work site, you know what I mean? At the job. We were very, very blessed to be doing what we were doing. And so I told everybody, you were the leader on EMP. I remember very well you telling me the story when I first got there. You had sat through, this is before I arrived, a classified briefing in the House Armed Services Committee laying out the vulnerability of the U.S. electric grid, completely unnecessary, something that should have been taken care of a long time ago. And you said that's what motivated you to first say, hey, somebody's got to get on this. You know, you see it all the time on Capitol Hill. There's this problem. We talk about it. Who's going to get on this and get this done? And so you founded
Well, that's true. I mean, you laid it out very well. In 2004, the EMP Commission that was essentially kind of Reagan's Einstein was the chairman of it. And they reported to the Armed Services Committee and gave us what was a pretty terrifying report. In fact, I still remember Chairman Duncan Hunter at the time took us into executive session immediately. It's the only time I ever saw that happen in the 15 years I was in Congress, because he was so, recognized the seriousness of what we were talking about, and also recognized the danger of us really letting potential enemies be privy to how serious the problem was and what a potential military advantage someone that was offensively capable to use electromagnetic pulse against a country like America. He recognized that, and it was one of those things where it was so impactful to me that I thought, we've got to try to address this. And there were some of those, as you said, those dark years on the other side of the moon where no one was really paying much attention to it. Roscoe Bartlett was one of the earlier guys that paid attention to it. He was an engineer. My background's engineering. It was ironic that, with all due respect, you were one of the few lawyers that got it, but the lawyers didn't really understand the situation, but the engineers said, this is serious. And it took time, but over time, the issue became clear. And I will have to say, one of the things that probably jump-started this as much as anything was when North Korea bragged that they had both the capability and even the intent to use EMP against America. That seemed to really have a big impact on people. There were other milestones, but that was a big one.
Right. And so now there was a time when I was there and when some people didn't take North Korea very seriously. And then I know you know this, Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, began telling people, and I think he wrote it in the Wall Street Journal, he's like, look, people, they have a satellite in space that can do this. They can really do this. This isn't just a madman like likes to listen to himself talk. You know, this is a real threat. And so just for people to understand this, explain how we know that we can be harmed by North Korea, and I'm certain that the Iranians and the Russians also have designs that they've been pretty explicit about, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. There are five countries that have extensive EMP capabilities. I think two of them might still be classified, so I just don't talk about it much. But the ones that are obvious and in the full public domain are, of course, Russia and China and Iran. Now, that last one is more frightening to me than the others, because there's a certain unhinged issue with Iran. Now, North Korea also has the capability. They were classified for some time. We couldn't talk about it. Now we can to a much greater degree. But we know that, that there was, as you mentioned, a satellite that was coming directly overhead that had not only the proper altitude, but the proper trajectory. You know, the orbital trajectory was ideal if they had chosen to have a small, like a neutron-enhanced warhead that could have precipitated a significant EMP, and we would have never known it until the detonation occurred. What people forget is that a high-altitude nuclear burst, and this executive order of the president's actually articulates this in the executive order, that when a high-altitude nuclear blast occurs above 40 kilometers in elevation, it creates an interaction with the ionosphere here where you have a significant a gamma ray projection that then creates a massive rush of ionized particles that rushes toward the Earth and finds a major conductor, and then it begins to build an electron load. And what that just essentially means is that over time, whether it's major electric lines or whether it's almost anything that we use in the modern world, that we can just essentially fry them or overload them. And if we burn up a few of these little SCADA controls or something like that, it's an inconvenience. But if we start taking out major transformers, if they're under load and they arc over and burn the transformers up, then we have a serious problem where we lose our national grid. And the implications of losing our national grid is really something that I've avoided articulating in its pure sense, because it sounds like you're trying to use scare tactics. It is so frightening if it happens. The EMP Commission, and this is their words, not mine, suggested that 70 to 90% of the population of the United States would perish. Now, I've never said that. What I have said, that it would be extremely serious. And it's incumbent upon us as policymakers and as Americans in general to make sure we mitigate that problem.
We're talking with Congressman Trent Franks. Do I still call you that? Is that a title you get to keep, sir?
Jackie, you get to call me anything you want.
He's always Congressman Trent Franks to me, from Phoenix, Arizona. And we're discussing the president's new executive order to help protect the U.S. electric grid against attack. We have to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show, and we're continuing a conversation with Congressman Trent Franks. And he is the former chairman of the Congressional EMP Caucus. And we're talking about the president's new executive order to protect the U.S. electric grid, finally, against threats, whether it is hostile foreign nations, Russia, China, Iran, or whether it is natural forces. About every 150 years, the sun has a storm, if you want to call it that, or throws out solar flares that actually are capable of frying electronics. That wasn't a big problem in George Washington's day. It is the end of America as we know it today if we have no electricity. So, Congressman Franks, when we went to break, we were talking about just basically what would happen if the U.S. grid went down. I'm told if you hit one transformer, this can like cascade from transformer to transformer, taking down the full grid. Takes about, what, 18 months to manufacture these things. People don't understand, have no reference point for that. We've never seen that happen before.
No, we really don't. Go ahead.
Where the whole world falls apart there, people don't understand, how can a grid going down cause human death? Can you explain the sequence of events that would result in human fatalities because of a grid failure?
Well, you know, Jackie, physiologically, we're not so different than human beings were 2,000 years ago. But there is a totally different environment we live in, a totally different culture of existence that we are now a part of, where if you really had to point to some major component that really made our lives different, I would suggest to you that electricity, the availability of electricity, is one of the main things that separates us from some of the, you know, the dark ages or the times where we didn't have the modern capability we have. Certainly we've got a different war machine. But when you consider what electricity does for us, it moves our water, it moves our sewer system, it lights our homes, it powers so many things in the home. It is the basis of our communication. It's the basis for our financial systems. There's so many of our hospitals. So many things that we do every day are vitally dependent upon electricity. And this thing called the grid is the largest mechanism ever built by human beings, that is an actual machine. The Great Wall of China was perhaps maybe larger in size, but in terms of it being a machine, the largest machine ever built by humankind is the electric grid. And if that should fail, and unfortunately, electromagnetic pulse is one of the scenarios that could precipitate that, and we've done a lot to try to ameliorate that since we began working on this issue. But if that should fail, the result would be a tragedy. You know, we're only about 16 meals away from shooting each other if we start to miss those meals. And a societal breakdown would ensue if we had a complete loss of our electric grid. And I just have to say to you that it's also in almost any schooled tactician with related to national security, it's one of our most significant national security threats. Iran has written a complete plan. They call it passive defense. That's a terrible name for what they've come up with, a plan to use EMP against more powerful nations like the United States. But it is a sound plan. It is a threat to the United States. The terrorists, I think, could see this as sort of a kill switch to attack America with. And it's just something that we need to deal with. We can. The wonderful news is we can fix it. And we should be about doing that. And it took the Trump administration coming to power to say that we're going to do something. You know, I have to say, Donald Trump does not speak diplomat. He may not say things all in the way that all of us would like to say it. But by God, if you look at what this man is doing, you see a completely different attitude than we've had in the White House for certainly as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
And this is just one of them. This executive order that he's written is extremely well written. It covers everything. And I want to really, just congratulate all the people that had their part in it. Some of them I know. But this was extremely well done, and I really want to congratulate the President of the United States for doing something to begin to protect this country against one of our major national security threats.
Well, and it's a reminder that when you elect a president, you're electing an army of people. When I saw this order, I thought, wow, he is listening to the right people. Because I'm thinking about, you know, before he was elected, I don't think Donald Trump knew much about electromagnetic pulse or late term abortion or, you know, border security or whatever. No one does. And when people were deciding who do I vote for, all they wanted to talk about was the flaws of the individual candidate. But when you elect a candidate, you're electing a team, hundreds of appointees, maybe hundreds of federal court judges, people who he's listening to on these issues. And obviously, Congressman Franks, he's listening to our friends. He's finally taking this seriously and getting it done. Every president had the ability to do what he just did and chose not. They were listening to the wrong people.
That's right. You know, at there was a time when if you were concerned about EMP, they tried to put a little tin hat on you and make you some sort of a reactionary. When the truth is, we've spent literally billions of dollars over the last two decades hardening our critical defense structures. And so the military is aware of this. They have never doubted the significance of it. But what we've overlooked as a people is that the military is dependent upon the civilian grid for 99% of its electricity needs, without which it cannot affect its mission. Now, what I just said is of consequence. That means that apart from the civilian grid, our military is distinctly and demonstrably diminished, not completely disabled, but very significantly reduced to the point where they would not be able to, in their own vernacular, affect their own mission. And so that means that we've somehow gotten a loss of who's in charge here. The private sector says, well, the federal government shouldn't tell us how to protect the grid, because after all, this is a private sector. We're not in charge of national security. And by the same token, the military says, well, we're not in charge of the civilian grid. And the result is that the issue sort of wanders around on the 13th floor of the policy debate with no place to stand. And I see that this president is taking a hold of it in a way that I think is going to precipitate a very favorable outcome in the long run. You know, Jackie, our office was the first to implement major legislation on EMP. It was called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. And I take some great consolation or encouragement from the conclusion of my part that has helped to promote us to a point where the President of the United States finally understands the significance of it and has taken the action that he has today or just recently.
There's no question. There's no doubt about it. You had a win with that piece of legislation, which means there was critical mass behind supporting the idea and even caring about the problem. And I thought it was interesting. I knew you had won when I saw both the executives of Southern Company and Duke Energy go into the press and say, hey, we're going to change our position on this whole issue of grid security. Because, what you just said, they're like, not our job. Now they're saying, hey guys, you know what? If North Korea launches an attack on us, we're just Southern Company. We can't do anything about it. We need you guys to do something. And I remember reading this thinking, are you kidding me? You all are the people who have been standing in the way saying, don't even think about touching this grid and regulating the grid, okay? Because we're the private sector. And here they are changing their tune. So how did that happen? Do you know?
Well, there was a few heroes within the industry, and I don't discount or debase the industry in any way in general, Jackie. But there were a few special heroes. Terry Boston was one of them. You know, he ran essentially the largest portion of our grid back in the Midwest and the East Coast, and he was amazing out of Pennsylvania, and he became part of this entire discourse, and he essentially said to his industry partners, "Hey, listen. This represents a profound liability to the industry. If we have a major tragedy and many loss of life, it will be very easy for people to say, you guys are in the industry. You're the engineers. You know that this risk was real and you didn't do anything about it." And he reminded them of that. And so for self-preservation purposes, they kind of began to come to the table. And then there was a major, I think, seminal meeting that I had the privilege of going to with Terry and others in England here some years ago, we visited up at the top floor there of Lloyd's of London, and they were, you know, the underwriters, the insurance underwriters of protecting, ensuring the grid, as it were. And they recognized, and I saw it happen in that meeting, they recognized that they themselves, as an insurance company, were also subject to tremendous liability. And, you know, money talks. They began to say, hey, we should look at this. And when they really looked at it, honestly, all of a sudden they realized, hey, we cannot be passive anymore. And people became, you know, more willing to listen to each other. And the big companies said, well, you know, if the little companies, if we don't do some sort of overall blanket legislation, then the little companies will ignore it and they'll have a market advantage on us. And so we better try to pull everyone together and do this. And I really pat a guy named Terry Boston on the back for being the industry leader that really precipitated that. And then that allowed us to get our legislation passed. And when our legislation passed, it was the first major legislative bill on EMP to ever pass the Congress. Then all of a sudden, it seemed like a lot of other things began to come into place. And when Barack Obama got elected, he pretty much ignored it completely. But then there was enough people in the industry that continued to build in their knowledge. And then when Donald Trump got elected, we had access. And over time, and I think in a fairly short period of time now, he has written what is a comprehensive executive order. And I believe someday, Jackie, that there will be some type of major EMP event, whether it be natural or otherwise. And the effect, because we have mitigated it, will be so little as a result that only a few people will know what a monstrous tragedy has been avoided.
I certainly hope you are exactly right about that, sir. We have to go to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show, and we're continuing a conversation with Congressman Trent Franks, who was really the leader in the U.S. Congress for protecting the U.S. electric grid from EMP, electromagnetic pulse, and other threats. He chaired the EMP caucus, and now we see all of that work coming to fruition. This week, as Donald John Trump issued an executive order, basically, finally, after decades of work, requiring that this issue of the vulnerability of the U.S. grid be addressed. And so while we were on break, Congressman Franks reminded me of the potency of this issue in a conversation he had with Judge Jeanine Pirro, which I'm sure is not top secret and you can repeat, sir. Tell us what Judge Jeanine, who has been a guest on the Jackie Daly Show, by the way, had to say about this issue.
Well, that's pretty wonderful. You know, I've had the privilege of being on Judge Jeanine's program many times, and I hold her to be a great American hero. She speaks her mind, and a lot of people don't like that. But I will just say to you, this lady is not only brilliant, but she has a heart for America, and we would all do ourselves a favor and America a favor to listen more carefully to what she has to say. And I know she's run into a few bumps in the road, but let me suggest to you that I think she should be back on the air yesterday. And I really appreciate the help that she gave us early on, because she allowed us to be on her program to talk about EMP when we were trying to get, you know, critical members of Congress to put aside their political connections to some of the grid operators that didn't want anything to upset to anything that they were doing. And Judge Jeanine helped us get information out that really, really was vitally important in those early days. And I just want to thank her on this program, Jackie, because she did a great thing. She at that time had said that when she did her program on EMP, that she had more response on this issue than she had had on any other issue that she had ever dealt with on her program. And I think that's significant because it really points out two things. Number one, that those who understand the EMP issue wanted to respond and to give her program input, and they're glad that she did this. And also, it resonated with the general public. Thank God the public is not nearly as stupid as the media would hope them to be.
Right.
In general. And they recognize that this is serious. They somehow recognize, okay, if you lose electricity for a few days, you do a barbecue, and you sit out and you have a little, maybe a little campfire in the backyard, and you tell stories. But after about a month, when nothing works, then it becomes a crisis of the first magnitude. And the people realize that, and they resonated to it. So I, again, I'm kind of in almost a celebratory mindset today, because I see that the President of the United States and the U.S. government is now addressing this issue in a way that is clear by the way they've written this executive order, that they understand it and that they are now acting in a way that I think will lead to eventually seeing our grid hardened.
So,
and I really am grateful for that.
So who do you think, because I mean, the order says this issue has to be prioritized, which is key language in federal law. Who, if you're comfortable naming names, which individuals do you think were most influential on the president on this?
Well, I have to say probably one of the greatest minds on the issue, I'm going to be in trouble here with half of them, but probably one that I worked with the closest was Dr. Peter Pry. I mean, I went and of course the heads of the EMP commission, and these people, literally I went to Israel with them and we did an analysis of the Israeli grid. And the Israelis were, their leaders were very polite to us, and they listened to us. They didn't say much. We didn't know whether they were rolling their eyes or what. But then 6 months later, they came to Washington and said, thank you for awakening us. And now Israel, you know, has been involved in the process of hardening their grid now for a number of years.
Yeah.
So they'll probably be the first country in the world that will be hardened. And I think that's very important. I got tickled here just as an aside. They said, well, we really think this is a very attractive problem. Now, they said this in open session, so I'm not articulating any sensitive information. They said, this is an attractive problem. I thought, attractive? This is an existential threat. And they said, yes, but Israel has all kinds of existential threats. We can fix this one.
Yeah, right. And, a problem we can actually so, tackle and fix.
You know, it's not only a threat to us, we can fix it. And they're about doing that. And once again, they're ahead of the rest of the world, and England is starting to move in the right direction. So I'm encouraged. I've seen since our legislation has occurred that many of the critical defense mechanisms in this country have had their sources for electricity hardened, and so that there's a much more of a redundancy and a security there. So I'm encouraged. We're going in the right direction. I hope we just keep going before anything happens, because remember, said something I stole from a guy in California years ago. When a crisis comes, you do not rise to the occasion. You default to your level of preparation.
Yeah.
And we're now beginning to prepare like that. And I'm, again, quite encouraged.
Well, I'll share with you an experience I had with Israelis yesterday. I was leaving Reagan National Airport and up pulls the big Trump plane. And yesterday was APAC's day on the Hill. So beside me in the airport was a lot of Israeli guys, young guys, and they all began like talking excitedly in Hebrew. And I, of course, I don't speak Hebrew. I don't know what they're saying. All that I knew is that every other word was Melania, Melania, Melania. I was like, I think I know what they're talking about.
She is a great lady. And, you know, I really, once again, before we lose opportunity to express it, Jackie, want to thank you, but also want to say again how much I appreciate the President of the United States for dealing with this issue, because long after he is gone, what he has done here will resonate to the protection of my children and hopefully someday my grandchildren, and as well as yours and others. And this is a big deal, because there's really two things that we need to deal with this crisis in the long run. We need a national standard whereby we harden our grid to a specific EMP intensity. In my judgment, it should be at least 200 kilovolts per meter in the intensity range. And that's something that this order of the president's will eventually discover. And then the second thing is, we need to make sure that the president or some regulatory mechanism exists, which does not now, to, without costing the civilian grid a significant amount of money, with something that they can recover their cost, that we can harden the civilian grid to that standard. If we do those two things, we're telling Iran, we're telling Russia, we're telling China, there's no point in trying to take down our grid, because it's not going to work and you'll just make us mad. And those are the things that we need to do. Right now, they know that we're still vulnerable. And vulnerability is an invitation, in my judgment, to conflict. And I just, again, thank the president for what he's done here. And I hope that the rest of the administration, the rest of the policymakers in America realize what he's done and follow suit.
Well, and what you're saying as far as the deterrence is the Reagan doctrine, peace through strength.
Yes.
And it's also, in some ways, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. Now, that is mostly referring to a military that can strike. But at the same time, strength means being able to defend yourself as well. And this is such a basic thing, you know. And
yeah, you might need to take that first punch and survive it so that then you can launch your offense, you know, your response. But if we're in a situation where we're susceptible to a first attack that then almost debilitates our ability to respond, that's a terrible place to be. And this president is taking us out of that position. And once again, that's a peace through strength. It's, you know, Ronald Reagan's peace through strength was a talk softly and carry a big stick, but it seemed like to Donald Trump, you need to talk in a whisper and carry a howitzer. And that seems to be the way he's proceeded. And I, again, very grateful for his effort today.
We've been talking with Congressman Trent Franks, and he was my boss for 7 years on Capitol Hill in one capacity or another, either in his personal office or when he was chairing the subcommittee on the Constitution. He also chaired the Congressional EMP Caucus, which protects the electric grid. And we've been talking about the president's brand new executive order to protect the grid, finally, after decades of work. If you're just now joining us, you can always catch the entire interview with Congressman Franks on the podcast. It's easy. Just Google Jackie Daily Show, iHeartRadio, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, Omni, wherever quality podcasts are found. You can find Jackie Daily Show and subscribe for free. And you should. And join the mailing list. It's easy. Go to my Facebook page, The Jackie Daily Show, and sign up. We're going to launch that mailing list again. So don't miss it. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Daily Show. You can follow us online on Twitter at Jackie Daily Show, or subscribe to any of the podcasting outlets, but my favorite is SoundCloud.com. I think it's the most user-friendly. Check that out. How do you feel about abolishing daylight savings time? Am I the only person in the country who would love to see the whole country on one time zone? I'm thinking to myself, how many times has someone missed a flight because they booked the time and thought it was a different time zone, or missed a meeting because someone is on Central Time and someone is on Eastern Time. I think this has to cost the U.S. economy money. I don't like it. It's inconvenient, right? Why should I have to spring forward and fall back and all this business? I for one, am 100% in favor. I've been wondering my whole life, why do we do this? Well, I've learned the answer this week, and I've learned there's actually a movement afoot to abolish daylight savings time. And while, you know, it's not as big a priority for me as like fighting the pro-pot movement or something like that, which I mentioned otherwise in the show, I actually really, really like this idea. To me, it's common sense. I'm not going to say it's easy, right? There'd be some adjustment, but this can actually happen. And in the Trump era, things happen all the time that you never dreamed would happen, no matter what we've done for decades. So I found out that my friend, Jason Isaac, who is a senior manager and distinguished fellow at Texas Public Policy Foundation, actually carried this bill to abolish daylight savings time in the state of Texas. Okay, as a Texas state rep, not federal, but state. And the movement continues. And I hope it's picking up steam. And I also found out this is all about energy. You know why we have time zones? Did you know it's all about saving energy for World War I? That's why we ever had this in the first place. Jason taught me all this, and there's so much more to learn. I did not know. I actually had no idea of the history of this. I was completely woefully uninformed. Jason Isaac, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be back on, Jackie. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. So obviously the show is about energy and environment. And we learn now that the Germans brought this on us in World War One, in 1918, you told me. And so why, explain this. Why is this a good idea to win a world war? Why do you need daylight savings time?
Well, the Germans did it in the, you know, during World War One as an effort to save energy costs for the war. And it did anything but that. And they actually showed that there was more consumption of energy, although they didn't realize that for years and years later. But that's what this whole momentum was about, was we've got to save energy. So if we spring forward in the spring and then we set our clock back an hour in the fall, then we're going to save a ton of energy. And the last people that we should be following our energy policy is the Germans.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. I am constantly...
I know, here we are 100 years later.
I use Germany as a punching bag all the time. And you know what? I visited there twice last year. It's a fine country in many ways. But if there's one thing you don't follow the Germans on, it's governance, right? And policy. You're the worst. It'll be hard to imagine.
It leads to waste of energy and higher costs.
Unbelievable. And so, okay, so they're like, great, we got to win this war at all costs. I know, daylight savings time. Then England follows right behind them, and we did the same. Now, what's interesting, Jason, is we have lots of time zones in this country, right? Germany only has one, right? Am I wrong?
Right.
And so, and the UK only has one. I think they have the Greenwich line runs right there. So I've been told my whole life that we did this because America was an agricultural country and the farmers needed and wanted this. Is that a complete lie?
I really think it is. It was, you know, hey, we'll have more sunlight in the morning and more sunlight in the evening, as if man can actually control when the sun is shining. They decided that they could by switching clocks around. It's just a, you know, misnomer, and it certainly didn't affect the amount of sunlight that we had during the day by any means whatsoever. And this was not done for farmers. It was following misguided policy from Germany 100 years ago to spring forward an hour in the spring of every year and fall back in the fall. And it's interesting. This is a very hot topic. I had no idea when I filed the bill last legislative session in 2017 in Texas, how many people would contact my office in favor of eliminating daylight saving time and in just favor of stopping the switching of the clocks.
I
could not believe it. Never had an issue that I've worked on legislatively that attracted more attention than this one right here. And it's, people just do not like to change the clocks, and studies have actually shown that it's a negative thing. When you actually have more heart attacks and more health issues within the week following, whether you spring forward or fall back, within that week following that event, you have an increase in car accidents because people are fatigued, whether they've gotten too much sleep or not enough sleep. And then there's a big increase in strokes and heart attacks that are directly attributable to this man-made policy of us switching the clocks. And that was one of the reasons I carried the legislation 2 years ago and support it to this day. Let's just stop changing the clocks. I know there are some people that want more sunlight in the evening, and it's others that want it in the mornings. I don't care. I'll adjust my work schedule. Let's just quit changing the clocks twice a year to the detriment of a lot of people.
Well, and it kind of blows my mind that you just said that. There are more car accidents and more heart attacks and strokes in that week. You know what? It makes a lot of sense, because some people, right, they're at the end of the rope. They can't have one more thing fall on them, one more thing go wrong, one more thing screw up, and they're going to lose their job or whatever. You know, it's not really an understatement, and I get it. So let's make life as simple as possible, basically. And I think it has to help business. The reason I get excited about this, Jason, is because to me, you and I brainstorm policy ideas, hopefully for people who listen. And this is such low-hanging fruit. This is so easy in my eyes compared to everything else we have to tackle. I feel like you make this change and stop jerking around with the business calendar and day, and there has to be immediate benefits just for leaving things lie to nature, or at least that's what I believe about that. I mean, when you were running this bill, did you learn anything about like economic studies or what people thought we would gain in GDP or something if we just stopped changing the daggone clock artificially?
Yeah, and the economic studies had a lot to do with the health and the vehicle accidents that I talked about. And that has a big impact on people's livelihood and their daily lives. And I'm extremely cautious every twice a year after we change the clocks, watching out for drivers, being extremely defensive in my driving, because I know there are people out there that are struggling with their health because of this policy. And it's just absurd. And I will say there's an overwhelming majority of people that want to eliminate daylight saving time. But the problem is those people are split, and they're split pretty evenly about what they want to do. There are some people that want to have daylight saving time, or they want to be in daylight, standard time, where there's about half the contingent of people want to spring forward and stay there when they say they have more sunlight in the evening. And there are some people that say we want to fall back and have more sunlight in the morning. Again, we can't control when the sun's going to go up and down every day. The earth is going to continue to spin. And if we went with Zulu time, which is the world clock where everybody's on the same time, it wouldn't matter. Some of us would be going to work. It could be 1 a.m., but that used to be 8 a.m.
Yeah, what's the difference?
I agree. I'd love to have one clock where it's the exact same time all around the earth. And there is a clock out there. It's called the Zulu time that some airlines observe, so that they don't miss flights and when they're doing their flight scheduling. But as man, we invented these time zones, and then we added daylight saving to make our life more confusing and stressful. And so I'm with you. I'd love to have one time. It's the same time all the way around the world, and get people on that system.
Well, and it's a good time to note that about one third of the world's countries do not observe daylight savings time whatsoever. You've got two states and several U.S. territories that don't. And despite what the Germans claimed during World War I, it doesn't save energy. The Smithsonian quote you sent me, it says, quote, despite its name, daylight saving has never saved anyone anything, unquote. So how about we just end it? Now, the Smithsonian and I don't agree on much, especially wouldn't agree with you and I on our, holding climate scientists to some kind of a standard. I can say that from watching their recent productions.
Yes.
But in any event, so Jason Isaac ran this bill. He is a senior manager and distinguished fellow at Texas Public Policy Foundation, specifically with Life Powered. And before that, a Texas state rep who now has passed the baton for this policy onto other members down at the Austin State House. So thank you so much, Jason, for coming on. I hope that Americans will have increased serotonin levels and vitamin D production from your policies and all the hard work and foundation you've laid. I'm actually very excited about this. And thank you for doing it, Jason. It's cool.
2400 2 years ago. This year, it's House Bill 49 by Representative Lyle Larson. So it looks like it's pending in committee right now. So House Bill 49, call your state rep and encourage them to support it.
All right. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Subscribe for free at SoundCloud.com and follow us on Twitter at Jackie Daly Show. You know, all of us have the right to factor into our government up in Washington. We all have a voice. It doesn't just mean voting. It means you can also reach out to stakeholders in Washington, D.C. and tell them what you think. This means things like writing your congressman or senator. It also means you can comment on proposed regulations that agencies put out there through the Federal Register, and a lot of associations do that. You can also just contact your president. You know what? You can write to the White House. You can show up at events where influential people are and make your voice heard. I will admit, having worked in Washington for a while, the impact of a single letter or communication to a congressional office, I will not lie to you, is probably marginal. The way things have worked in the past, literally, there is a staff person in each congressional office whose job it is to correspond with constituents, right? This is called the legislative correspondent. This is usually an entry-level position, and this person writes letters, right, for the congressman to respond to the thousands of letters that come in. And so that person might or might not pass your message along to the congressman. You know what I'm saying? What does happen in good offices that are responsible is that that legislative correspondent will tally up the letters received, let's say, in favor of a bill or against a bill. And so the congressman would commonly ask, and most of them do, okay, you know, whatever, pick one, Obamacare. How many people wrote in on behalf of it? How many people against it? And then there are some of these, like, you know, what they call AstroTurf campaigns. There's grassroots, which is like real people writing real letters with real opinions. And then there's AstroTurf, which is fake grassroots. And these are groups that are organized by a handful of people. They come together. They make a few people look like a chorus of millions, and they start these bombardments of letters and petition drives into congressional offices. And some people feel like they make themselves look more important than they are. So when a congressman or an agency sees that kind of a campaign come in, usually the staff will be sophisticated enough to say, oh, you know what? Okay, so they have 1,000 letters in this direction. That was kind of a paid for campaign. How do we know these people are even real, right? So you look for ways to make yourself stand out. I've now seen Washington from several angles, right? I was there as an entry level staffer, an intern way back in the day in the 90s. Later, I was deputy chief of staff and counsel to a congressman, chairman of a subcommittee. And now, you know, there I am on the outside after going to Dallas with nonprofit think tanks, policy shops, and also from the donor circle. So I've seen it from just about every angle. And now I have a much better understanding of why things were happening the way they were. Staffers don't always understand. How can it be? You know, you've got all these people, this overwhelming campaign calling in and demanding change. When I first went to the Hill, there were two big issues in 2006, I believe it was. Number one, immigration. You might not remember this. People were demanding action on the border. Long time ago. Can you imagine where we would be today if that had ever been done and gotten done? What I mean is, what, you've got maybe 10 phone lines in a congressional office? You've got 10 staffers. Every time one of us would put the phone down, it would just ring again. You pick it right back up. The phone lines would stay lit up. And do you know what could make that happen? Talk radio. Seriously. The only thing that I knew for sure that the Republican leadership, at least, feared was talk radio. It's what Speaker Boehner, back then Leader Boehner, called governance by talk radio. And he hated it. Hated it. Oh, yeah, no, I'm getting some reaction here through the glass here in the studio. We have some opinions about former Speaker Boehner, who now devotes his talents to, advocating for pot, for marijuana. Boy, that seems important. Of all the problems we could all tackle, it's where the money is. I'm not going to comment on that right now. This is a show about energy and environment, but I have some strong opinions. I think there's probably a better use for Boehner's talents, such as they are. If I were a former speaker, I would choose other things. How about that? Back to advocacy. You know, people don't give talk radio its proper weighting when it comes to influence. Do you recall that Eric Cantor, the former whip and then leader, right, of the House, was taken out by a guy named Dave Bratt? This is in Virginia. A no-name guy, no one ever heard of him, didn't know him. Cantor had the huge fundraising advantage. It was both Mark Levin and Laura Ingraham who were credited with going into Virginia, campaigning against Eric Cantor and having the challenger take him out. People thought it was not possible, but that is the influence of talk radio hosts. So, okay, at that time, I looked into it. Like, I'm like, can that be right? Like, I believed it because I love those two hosts. I love them both. Back then, if you took a look at ratings, right, which, by the way, are very imperfectly done, they're one indicator. But the truth is they don't even survey the overwhelming majority of Americans to find out what they're listening to. At that time, I think Rush Limbaugh had like 15 million unique listeners a day. Average listening time, 11 minutes. 11 minutes in a 3-hour show. So that's the top guy. Why is it like that? Because most people who listen to conservative talk radio work for a living. That's why. They work jobs. And so they don't have all day to listen to full shows, unless they have a job that might permit that. People listen as they're driving from point A to point B. Maybe that drive lasts 11 minutes on average. But the bottom line is you had Limbaugh and then right behind him Hannity at about 14 million listeners a day. And then it dropped down to like 7 or 8 million listeners a day. And there you had Glenn Beck, Mark Levin, and others. A handful of people. And then it dropped way down to about 3 million a day. And this is terrestrial talk radio. But the point is, when talk radio decides to launch a grassroots campaign, you know what? There can be power in that. That has really worked. As someone who sat in a congressional office and watched this go on, that can really work. They can light up the phones. It does get the attention of the leadership. They do fear talk radio. And okay, I'm going to be perfectly forthright with you. That's why I wanted to do it. That's the real reason why I wanted to do this. Ever. I also thought that talk radio might be the only place that rewards my personality. Working in the law firm right out of law school, see, they don't appreciate opinions and boldness and creativity, original ideas. No. Now, maybe that's just because law has a bias, right? To rely on precedent. You don't invent new things in law. Unless you're some, raging liberal socialist that wants to overthrow the government or something. It's not appreciated, not in law. And then I went to Capitol Hill. I worked for a boss that rewarded boldness. Some did, some didn't. But even so, guess what? When you work for an elected official or an appointed official, you don't get to have any opinions. There's only one opinion in that office, and that's the boss's. And you promote the boss, right? You push his opinion out there. I don't care what he believes. That's what you believe publicly. So it still was very confining. Lucky for me, I worked for a member of Congress with whom I agreed about 99% of the time. So it wasn't much of a conflict. But the point is, talk radio is still a very powerful medium. People like it. I just saw the Nielsen report showing that more people actually touch talk radio than almost any other media source. Right, ages 12 to 49, 59. This is radio. This is not podcast. And of course, podcasts are exploding. You should see the stats on podcasts. Basically, for the last, I don't know how many umpteenth years, it's been growing about 5% a year. Do you know about compounding interest? It's kind of a big deal. All right, if you could do that, compound the number of listeners by 5% over the year before, it's huge. Yeah, so here's where I'm coming to. Yes, it's true. People in Washington can dismiss your opinion if you're one person crying in the wilderness. But there are people who get through. There are campaigns that work. There are things that get their attention. And it almost requires organization. So I have decided to make my opinions known now as a person who's been there and left, not only through the radio, but as some friends in high places in Washington, all over the place. I am actually still shocked that Donald Trump won. I still stand amazed. Even today, I still can't believe it. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about those ideas later in the show. Going to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Follow us online. Not just on JackieDaly.com, but also you can follow me on Instagram, Twitter, at Jackie Daly Show. On The Jackie Daly Show Facebook page, as distinct from my private page, which shall remain unnamed. Can't give you my last name. I'm in the Witness Protection Program. And, you know, you can also subscribe for free, and you should, on the iHeartRadio app, iTunes, SoundCloud, if you prefer, Stitcher, and others. For me, it was a really upsetting week because we watched what I thought was the finest EPA administrator in the history of the United States, Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt of Oklahoma used to be the attorney general there. You might recall he and the attorney general of Texas, Ken Paxton, teamed up frequently to take on the federal government in court. I believe it's true that no one sued the Obama administration more often than Scott Pruitt. At least I'm talking now about energy and environment issues exclusively. And so for that, he was rewarded by the appointment to the EPA by President Trump. You know, one qualification for getting into the Trump administration, you have to have expressed contempt and disdain for an agency to lead it, or at least, you know, even better, call for its abolishment, Rick Perry, then you get to lead the place, you know, that puts you first in line. And this is a healthy thing because, you know, the bias is you want people who believe government's too big and who want to get the boot off the neck of small business owners. These are people. So I'm not talking about issues here. I'm talking about people, real people in real lives. And so Scott Pruitt was like, I think the only appointee that was actually on track, or so I was told, in Washington, to meet the president's mandate to review the size or reduce the size of his agency, right? Remember, we talked about 10%, and some people talked about 40%. Scott Pruitt was moving faster, I believe, based on everything I can learn, than any other appointee to actually follow through on that commitment to do that. Also, last I was in Washington, I heard Steve Moore, the economist, say that he had been following Pruitt. Pruitt, according to Steve Moore, has cleaned up more Superfund sites in 1.5 years than the Obama administration cleaned up in 8 years. Did you hear me? Scott Pruitt, who the greenie, the militant, you know, greens, have bashed and bashed and bashed, and now finally succeeded in getting him to leave. This is the guy they want to get rid of. Well, you know, and I was thinking to myself, maybe he just finally got one death threat too many against his kids. You know that. We've talked about that in the past. You don't realize politics is a very dangerous game. You don't see that side of it. They often don't publicize it. When I worked on Capitol Hill, those kinds of things got immediately referred to the Capitol Police, and preferably they're kept under wraps, right? Because you don't want to signal anything to the terrorist who's threatening a member of Congress who's carrying a piece of legislation. And you do understand this word terrorist is badly abused by the media. What it really is, you know, a terrorist is not just a murderer. Those are two different things. Or an arsonist. A terrorist is someone who is trying to change public policy. They're trying to change geopolitics or a government or mount a coup, right? They have a goal that is far more than just the taking of human life. And so that's exactly what this is. When there's a threat on a public official, an appointed official, members of Congress, and it happens, and it's not as infrequent as you would hope. These things are all documented and followed closely. So yeah, Scott Pruitt spent a lot of money on personal security. He had no choice, okay? Because the lunatics from the other side who opposed his agenda wanted to have him killed, if we're to take them at their word, and his kids too. So do you think that justifies paying for security? Yes. So, you know, then it just got crazy. I mean, they would start with allegations like that, and then it went on to, he got a private test drive at Lexus at a dealership. Oh, really? Just like every other American that walks in there? I commented on this last week. My friend Rob Hennecke down at Texas Public Policy Foundation said, what, does he also get free peanuts on his Southwest flight too? You know, and that's how absurd this became. Anyway, so finally, it went on and on. I actually spoke to him when I was in Washington a couple of trips back. And I just said, listen, you know, I know this is a lot easier said than done, but you've got to absolutely guard your heart and your mind. You know, don't let these people permeate. Don't read these news stories. Have your counsel read it. Have your staff read it. If there's something you need to respond to or you need to know, have them tell you. You know, you don't need to be following the play-by-play and the hit-by-hit. But anyway, so he finally said in his resignation letter, and I wished he wouldn't have, he said after the unrelenting attacks of people in the media and other critics, he's stepping down. And similarly, Congressman Jim Jordan said something like that. You know, he gives an interview about this bogus, ridiculous claim by grown men trained in fighting that he refused to step in between, you know, them and the pedophile doctor. Except he's not a pedophile. These are grown men, okay? I already talked about that. Not going to get mad about that again. The point is, Jim Jordan also said that, you know, it was really getting to him. He was showing stress. He was kind of cracking under the pressure of having these people make accusations that were false, and it was hurting him. I suppose that helps make Jim Jordan a little more sympathetic to some people. Maybe he thinks he's going to get through to these guys who he thought were his friends. But you know what? I just think this is a mistake. These people who are under attack like Scott Pruitt and like Jim Jordan, you don't show weakness. You don't show you're cracking. You don't show any emotion about this. You have to be a stoic about this, because if they know it works, they keep doing it. All this does is chum the water. Now you're baiting the press corps. Now I'm telling you, they're popping corks right now in Washington over what they did to Scott Pruitt. That's a win. That's a scalp. It just validated everything they did. Why did he do that? I love Scott Pruitt. He's a good man. He's a really good guy. He's a smart guy, capable guy. You know what it is? No human being is immune to repeated trauma, you know, incessant trauma, especially against their own kids. Remember what they did to General Flynn? Went after his kid, right? And you see this throughout history. There's a lot of warfare that focused on these kinds of things. I mean, so anyway, you know, I'm not faulting them. I'm not in their shoes. I love both of them. But I just think saying those things was a mistake. You know, Jim Jordan will make it. That guy's like 401 in his wrestling record. And as I said in an earlier segment, you know, we worked in the same room together for years when he was on Judiciary Committee and I was counsel on the Hill. And, you know, he's this 5'5", super muscular guy. 401 record. Really impressive. Just a great man. He's going to be fine. He'll come through this. They're doing this to him because he's running for speaker right now. So notice they strategically dropped this on him right now. Want to hurt him, and, you know, with maximum impact on the agenda. Again, this is political. This is about keeping Jim Jordan from getting into the speaker's chair of the U.S. House. Probably the most powerful legislature on earth. You think that's worth a takedown job? Yeah. If that isn't what it is. You know, stop and think about this. The U.S. House holds the power of the purse of the U.S. government, the United States of America. I mean, how many trillions of dollars does the speaker have control over? He controls who gets appointed to the Committee on Appropriations, spends all the money. He controls, you know, who gets put on the foreign relations committees. It is the Senate that wages war, declares war, but we know that in real life, you know, deploying people overseas into triple canopy jungles or in the Middle East or elsewhere, we don't always have a declaration of war. Sometimes the House can simply authorize it and appropriate it, right? That's how powerful the Speaker is. So is that worth a takedown job? Yeah. So I will say this. I see good days ahead for Scott Pruitt. We were talking about it this weekend. What should Scott Pruitt do? Should he go into a big law firm? You know, he can totally cash out, right? A huge law firm, bill out at what? Seriously, I'm serious, like $1,000, $1,500 an hour to major firms regulated by the EPA to advise them. Of course, the firm takes a big cut. Should he do something else? My advice, if he's listening, Scott, would be to be a consultant. Working for yourself, and you don't even do a meeting with that six figures. Forget about it. You don't want to do anything short of that. Scott Pruitt can make millions and millions and millions of dollars now with his expertise. You know what? He deserves it. He should. For what he's been through, I'm not sure anyone in Washington has had it worse than Scott Pruitt over the last 6 months, more. I mean, death threats on yourself and your kids, having to constantly look over your shoulder. Why? Just so you can peel back regulations and make the economy run again. I mean, he's a public servant, and he has been for years. The guy's never cashed out. I think he should. I think he's extremely valuable, super smart, a great man, and he can write his own ticket now. He can call his own shots. And I think he should. I hated to see him go. I wish the resignation letter would have read a little differently. But, you know, nobody's perfect. I will never judge Scott Pruitt after what he's been through. All right, have to go to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Listening to The Jackie Daly Show, you can subscribe to the show for free on SoundCloud or iHeartRadio. Listen, did you hear about Duke University having to pay the U.S. government $112.5 million to settle accusations that it submitted bogus data to win federal research grants? Why am I telling you this? Because we've been talking about climate change, global warming, climate science, and every time we try to hold someone accountable for crazy, outlandish claims, then someone has to jump up on social media or wherever and say that we're anti-science. We just don't believe in science. You know, we despise and disparage PhDs and all this business. That's not true at all. What we disparage is a lie. What we disparage is fraud. And finally, someone gets caught. Duke University, by the way, this is no small deal. You know, Duke is properly, okay, they always say that Vanderbilt University, where I went, is the Harvard of the South. You know what? I love that, but that's not true. The truth is Duke is probably the Harvard of the South. This is a somewhat barely higher ranked institution, very prestigious. You know what? Maybe the University of Virginia is the Harvard of the South, actually. For whatever reason, Vanderbilt gets that name. We are a very highly ranked school, but we're not Virginia. I'm sorry, Vanderbilt people, but it's just true. We're not ranked as highly as those two schools. That's right. In law, at least. I was a lawyer. Am a lawyer. Here's the point. When someone finally gets caught, and what we've been telling you all this time is finally proven true in a court of law, I want to tell you about it. This is Duke. This isn't some two-bit school in the middle of nowhere. You know, scam school, online, offshore. No. This is a very well-respected institution. And $112 million is no small deal. That's kind of a big settlement. Okay, what happened here? This was a qui tam action. Qui tam, that is a Latin term. It's archaic and very old in the British common law. It means for the king. For the king. What am I talking about? Back in the days of Old England, you paid taxes to the king. And if you cheated the king and someone came forward, today we call them whistleblowers, and said, hey, king or king's men, over here is my boss so-and-so. And guess what? He's not paying all his taxes. He's hiding his assets. He lied to the feds, to the government. He defrauded you out of money that you rightfully deserve, king, whoever. Okay, if you would do this and narc out your boss, or basically, it didn't have to be your boss, if you just expose fraud, then the king would go take exactly what is owed to him and give you a cut. That's how it works. It's called a qui tam action. It means for the king. We don't have a king. This is the IRS now. It should be called qui IRS. That would be the proper term for this. But listen, it does serve at times a good purpose. For example, congratulations to my friend Trey Mayfield, one of my favorite legislators in D.C., one of my favorite lawyers. He just went to the U.S. Supreme Court on a qui tam action. And there, this person alleged that a federal contractor went overseas, billed the U.S. taxpayer for all kinds of stuff they were supposed to have done overseas. Well, they didn't do it or didn't do it right. You know, when you're cutting corners, you're not doing putting all the people on the ground you say you're going to, all the assets, whatever, and you defraud the government, you cheat the government, then a qui tam action will lie there. And so Trey there is representing the plaintiff as against the company that cheated us. You know what? You and I paid for that. Here, this is, I just put it on Trey's Facebook page, Trey, let me tempt you, .. And I posted this article from NPR laying out the Duke whistleblower suit. I'm like, let me give you a brand new, attractive target and use for your brand new qui tam expertise, because I'll bet you this is going on everywhere. I will bet you this is not just Duke University. They're not some bad apple in a bunch. I think if we did a deep dive in universities, we're going to find all kinds of problems, right? You just saw what happened. There's this big scandal where people are paying to get their kids into certain schools. And I was actually very unimpressed by how much money they were paying for what schools. I'm like, excuse me? You paid that much money for USC? Give me a break. But there's a lot of corruption. It's in sports. It's just in even academic scholarships. You name it. There are a million ways, right, for university actors who might be state schools. Even if they're not, they're accepting government money, right? And so if you're accepting government money, you'll be held to a standard. So I promise you, Duke is not the only school that has been engaged in this kind of misconduct. I want you to know what I know about quick cursory research. Thank you, Jeff Fisher, from Chewing the Fat. I find out here that in 2015, the University of Florida also paid out, what, about $19 million plus for the exact same kind of thing. Northwestern University 2013 paid over $2 million. 2015 again, another $2.7 million. Cornell University, an Ivy League institution, had to pay out $2.6 million. And listen, this is just what I know about. Okay, so not every case is reported. We don't know about everything. This isn't the kind of thing people broadcast. These university administrators don't run to the microphones to tell you how they feel about it and what they're going to do. But don't worry, Duke says they're on it. They're taking steps to improve integrity. I know you feel better now. Listen, this went on for 7 years. 7 years. Dozens of grants. Again, $112.5 million. The whistleblower who came forward received $33.75 million to Mr. Joseph Thomas, who reported that a researcher, what's her name? Erin Potts, I believe. She engaged in, quote, systematic and near universal research fraud, in some cases making up data outright in lieu of actually performing experiments. And what did she do with that data? She co-authored and published 38 articles in scholarly journals with her fellow Duke researchers, which were, in turn, cited in 417 other articles when the suit was filed in 2013. Do you hear what I'm saying? 417 times people picked up her work. No, you know, probably thousands and thousands of times. We have 417 articles citing to her work as if it's authoritative and means something, as if it has integrity. It was bought and paid for by you, the taxpayer. I bet it was even peer-reviewed. Know how we're not supposed to contest anything that's peer-reviewed? Now, listen, she was. Duke is not the only bad actor in the university world. This woman, in fact, was uncommonly bad. She was caught embezzling. She's an embezzler. Now, listen, there is a part of me that is sympathetic to this because bad people do get through. Good people do turn bad. You can't stop everything all the time. I will only say that Duke University, this went on for 7 years. Now, I've never been, one of the few things I haven't done in my life, is be a university administrator. I don't work in a university lab, but this seems a little off the charts. And you know what? I think Duke even kind of, sort of admitted that they fell short of a standard. So here's what Vincent Price said. I have a quote here. He says, quote, when individuals fail to uphold standards and those who are aware of possible wrongdoing fail to report it, as happened in this case. All right. So there's not just one bad actor who is, you know, the researcher. He's saying other people knew about it and were happy to stand by and let Duke take the money, knowing what was going on. He says we must accept responsibility, acknowledge that our processes for identifying and preventing misconduct did not work. They had the processes, he's saying. We just didn't, they didn't work. So here's my point. Something like this happens. For anyone to do something, they got to stick their neck out and put themselves on the line. You know what I'm saying? It's not comfortable being a whistleblower. This guy, Mr. Thomas, apparently was, quote, vilified and suffered substantial personal hardships, out of work for over a year. I can easily imagine that being the case. And, you know, a lot of people get ruined, right? You're always afraid, like, what if I lose? Well, you're going to take on an institution like Duke and its limitless resources and lose? Well, when you get the goods on something, and apparently Mr. Thomas did, no, you get $33.75 million. Now he's in the Italian Riviera somewhere on some big yacht drinking his martini. So he had the last laugh. By the way, would you like to know what this is about? You know what she was lying about? The lung function of mice. Now your blood pressure should skyrocket because taxpayers were paying that much money to study the lung function of mice. So I'm mad at the EPA and the National Institutes of Health, who she defrauded. And by the way, if you'd like to learn more about this kind of fraud in research, check out Retraction Watch. Retraction Watch. This is a website that says so far they've retracted 17 of her scientific papers, but I'd love to see what else is on Retraction Watch and see just how much. This is what gets caught, right? This isn't the whole universe of fraud. This is just what little teeny bit we know about. There's always far more beneath the surface. And so that is why when we have all this, you know, peer-reviewed scholarly work about climate change, it is every bit fair and right that we, the taxpayers who pay for this stuff, demand standards and apply scrutiny. What's wrong with that? It's what the scientific method's all about. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.